1990. This is Richard Dwelly interviewing James H. Bates, Chairman of the Board of Trustees of Sharon Hospital. The interview is being conducted for the Salisbury Oral History Project. Jim was a trustee, or has been a trustee, since 1981 and chairman of the board since 1982 to the present. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Dick.
Jim is going to speak to us about the early founding, briefly about the early founding of the hospital through to the present.
Right. Dick, Sharon Hospital was founded in 1909 by a Dr. Chaffee, and this is well documented in town histories and hospital reports. And he remained the president, chairman, chief doctor, and everything else for about 40 years, and really ran the hospital as a private fiefdom. He was apparently a man with very strong opinions and built it from a two or three bed house into a modern hospital for the period. I think that the beginning of Sharon's modern history really starts after World War II, when a group of men who had graduated from Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons and had all fought in World War II as young doctors decided they wanted to get out of New York and live in the country and practice in a small hospital. Fred Javault was one of that group, and I gather that his family had a summer home or a part-time home up here, and he brought George Haydock, Dr. Fowler, and two or three others with him. Joe Fisher, who's retired as OBGYN doctor, he was another of the founders, and they started what was called the Sharon Clinic. These were clearly fine men, talented physicians, who chose not to work in the city, and who like the lifestyle that you and I know we have up here in the country, with in a town without traffic lights and all of the good things that go with it, including sports and so on and so forth. I think that they really made Sharon Hospital a unique hospital in the time and the place, so that now, carrying on the tradition that they started, when people from the Joint Commission come, and we are inspected every 3 years by the National Accrediting Association from Chicago, the teams always come in and are dumbfounded at the equipment in the hospital, the medical competence in the hospital, the whole staff feeling. And all of this, I think, goes back to the fact that you had some top-flight professional leadership coming in the late 40s who really built the hospital and made it into a modern and somewhat unique establishment with knowing its limits. And I think this is one of the things that's a hallmark. We know we're a community hospital. We can treat a lot of things and some extremely well, but if the doctors don't feel that they can handle, either by virtue of equipment or training, a particular illness or injury, why, they'll be flown out to generally Hartford via LifeStar. And we actually use the LifeStar helicopter about twice a week. So the tradition is a deep one, with talented professional leadership and tremendous community support from the 17 towns in the three states that we serve. If you come up toward the present, in 1962, Paul Sternloff became the president of the hospital, and I'll mention him again. And he was its administrative head from then, from 1962 through 1987, serving 25 years as executive director. And then in the early 80s, because of the changing nature of the business and titles, why, he became president, and at that time I became chairman rather than president. The reason we did that is we went to meetings and people thought I was the president of the hospital and knew something, and that was a grave error. And so we made the titles more appropriate to the roles, where the chairman deals in policy primarily and the administrative head is the president. Paul retired in 1987. He has had a serious arthritis for many years, and this got to be more and more burdensome. And Jim Sock, who lives in Lakeville now, became the president at that time, and he is now in his early 40s, and I think we're well set for leadership for the next period. I think if we go back through my tenure as chairman, bringing us up to the 80s, that it's almost easiest to outline it and take it step by step, because there's been some significant things that have happened. In the fall of 1982, when I was elected chairman of the hospital, it was a 92-bed hospital, and we viewed hospital care in a traditional sense. In other words, people who were ill came into the hospital, stayed there, were treated, and then released. And the growth of the emergency room had already begun, but we didn't see this as the beginning of a whole different function and broadening of hospital services at that time. So we were, in every sense, a very fine, traditional 100 or 92 bed hospital. Shortly after I became chairman, while we started to look around, and partly by design, partly by good luck, and with very little brilliance involved, we realized that we were confined to the 5 or 6 area campus, and that there were going to be changes coming along, although we really didn't know what they were. There came up for sale an 11-acre piece of land across the street and down the hill from the hospital toward Sharon Valley, which is called the cornfield. I've never seen corn grown in it, but we called it the cornfield anyway. And we bought that 11 acres for $54,000 with no real idea of what the use would be for it, but feeling with the old saying that there's no more land being made, it would be a good idea to have it somewhat for protection in the future should we decide to expand in some way. That single move really began to raise the sights of the trustees as to future possibilities for the hospital. And so I'll come back to the growth. Well, perhaps now is the best time to talk about what we did vis-a-vis land. In 1984, give or take a year, Dr. Lavallo retired, and he was a surgeon who had served at Sharon for many years and had built a medical office building across the street, and he wanted to sell it. One afternoon, we were meeting at the hospital, and it was a group of officers. Dick Wardell was there, who was treasurer of the board and still is. Doran Sexton, who was vice chairman of the board and a former chairman of Johnson and Higgins and really a wonderful and devoted hospital servant, and I were meeting, and we realized that a lease had been let for a radiologist who we did not think should be in the building and competing with the hospital. That afternoon we decided to try and buy it. Dorrance and I went over and saw Dr. and Mrs. Lavallo, who, believe it or not, had trouble finding each other in their house. And the thing is so big. And after they found each other, we made an offer of $1,575,000 for the medical office building, 5 other buildings on the land, and 11 acres, and they accepted the offer. So we had a medical office building which we felt would serve the doctors well, because the clinic at that time was going out of business as an entity, and this provided a core office building for doctors to be served through. So this was a successful purchase. Doctors rented it, and they've rented it ever since, and matter of fact, we're now discussing the possibility of making this into a condominium type operation where the doctors could actually own their offices and we would own the outside of the building in a traditional fashion. This would give them the advantages of real estate, would give us more liquidity for other things.
Is there an expansion plan for this this condominium period, or just prior to it? Is anyone considering expanding the building?
No, we've bought other buildings since then, okay, which we'll talk about. That's a modular building that can be added to. So this is always a possibility, but we really haven't done that yet. We have bought other buildings on Hospital Hill Road where we have doctor's offices, and actually some doctors own them. Doctors Jensen and Roth own their own house and have their offices on Hospital Hill Road, for example, and we own two or three also. After we bought that building, we realized that we had 11 acres of land, and we began to realize the terrific need for continuing care, i.e. nursing home or assisted living care. So we began to develop a plan to build a nursing home for the hospital, and this plan has now been accepted by the state, I might add, 5 years later. And as I talk about the commission, I'll mention some of the tribulations we've had.
It's a recent occurrence too, isn't it?
The commission voted unanimously to support our application for 70 beds rather than 90, and that was passed in early August this year. So it looks like we're on track. Well, with 11 acres, we knew we could build a nursing home and have some land left over, so we began to think more and more of congregate housing, i.e. housing that we can all move into when we don't want to mow lawn and plow snow anymore, and where we can have either rent or own, and probably rent a two or three bedroom apartment or condominium. And we have begun to work with Church Homes, who are the owners of Noble Horizons, and we hope to develop a joint venture with them, and that's making slow progress, as these things always do. Concomitant with all of this thought, why, another piece of property contiguous to the medical office building came on the market called the Al Apt property, and that had 7 acres and a house, and we bought that, so that we now have the campus of the hospital itself, which is about 8 acres, the cornfield, which is 11 acres down across the hill, and then in the property across the street with the medical office building and the Apt property, we have an 18-acre plot of land on the southern side of Hospital Hill Road, which gives us plenty of land for the medical office building, the nursing home, and congregate housing to be developed in one campus, so that elderly people can come and live in the apartments with essentially total independence, but as if one or the other gets sick and has to have nursing home care, that can be conveniently located right close to their husband or wife. So we made these moves, which I think have been extremely valuable and I believe have moved us forward in our thinking, moving other things along with it. I think that another major factor, and this is my second point really, is what's happened to the medical staff in the last 8 years. I believe, and I could be off by one or two here, but we have about 34 full active members of the medical staff. Of these, since 1982, 18 are new doctors. This has occurred because the doctors who came in the late 40s and 50s obviously retired in the 80s and on toward 1990, so that there became openings within the medical staff beginning in the early 80s, and also the need for some additions. And so we have been able to recruit over the last 8 years some excellent new doctors who, again, for reasons of lifestyle primarily, want to be leaders in their profession, but also are committed to their families and a way of life that keeps them out in the country where sports and so forth are available. And of course, we're lucky here in that we have excellent schools around us, so that young doctors and their families have really tremendous advantage in terms of the way they live. We're very pleased with the three new anesthesiologists. Well, I'll say new here. This is within 8 years. Anesthesiologists, radiologists, orthopedic surgeons, and a general surgeon, family practitioners and internists. A variety of needs have been filled, and next June we have coming on board a new ENT, ear, nose, and throat doctor, and this is a slot we've been looking to fill for really 3 or 4 years, and we feel we found an excellent man. So that this medical staff has been rebuilt, which will be hopefully an active staff with the same people involved for the next 15 or 20 or 20 years. And I think this is something that was very important that evolved out of the peculiar breakpoint we were in time. The medical staff and the doc and the administration of the hospital and the trustees have been in a position during this last 8 years of what I like to call dynamic tension. Obviously, there's tremendous change in healthcare, and this is both challenging and frustrating. Connecticut has had a commission on health and hospitals, which has been at best confrontational toward hospitals and toward doctors. Their reason for existence is presumably to hold costs down, but they have done much more than this, and they have controlled our budgets in a fashion which has been very restrictive. And when we submit a budget, the budget package is literally over a foot high. And yet when budgets are solved, they are negotiated solutions which don't take advantage of any of the documentation. So it really is a case of a bureaucracy run wild. This control, the advent of new technology, which I'll talk about, an active young medical staff, and the changes that have occurred all have brought focused on potential conflicts between hospitals, their trustees, their administration, their medical staff, and other staff members. I think that we've survived very well. We have not been free of conflict, but I think that the medical staff understands the pressures on the hospital, and I think the hospital more and more understands the pressures on the doctors as they see the traditional role of a doctor not changing at its core, but how it's approached is changing tremendously. And this makes doctors very concerned about the future, and probably rightfully so. Another fact of the 80s, we've had the Health and Hospitals Commission being confrontational, but also there was developed a system of diagnostic related groups, or DRGs. And this is a plan that's been used for the last 5 or 6 years, or was for 4 or 5 years, and last year was thrown out. But it was a system where every illness would be paid a set amount, again in an effort to hold down costs, which really backfired. In other words, if you had appendicitis, you would come in and the doctors would be paid, and the companies would pay X dollars for your appendicitis. Now that looks fine on paper, but if you have a complication with your appendicitis, then are you treated for appendicitis or for the complication, and how much for which? And so there's nothing like a straight illness, and particularly as we deal with an older group of people, and I think it's 7% of the general population is over 65, and in the service area of Sharon Hospital, about 15% of the people are over 65. And so this really alters the approach we have to take to care, because the older one gets, the more things that are wrong, and the more that can go wrong in a hospital situation. Likewise, a person may be operated on for, say, a hip replacement, and if they're in their 80s, other complications come up, and Medicare says at the end of 3 weeks you're out of here, regardless of what the situation is. So the doctors and our doctors, sometimes at risk to themselves, will keep patients more than that three-week period because they simply feel they have to. Again, complicating this even more is the fact perhaps there is an 85-year-old widow who has to go home. She can't afford care. She should stay in the hospital. She can't get into a nursing home. So these are all very complex factors that really made the DRGs a poor system. That has now been removed, but some of the limitations, such as 3 weeks in the hospital, have not been removed. So that we're moving through a period of rapid change in the way health care is delivered, but we're not sure where we're going yet, and it has made life interesting. I think along with all of this, there has been a dramatic shift during the 1980s from, as I mentioned earlier, the hotel or inpatient operation of the hospital to an outpatient operation. I believe I'm very close to the figures. We had over 35,000 emergency room visits in the 1988-89 fiscal year. And this number is relatively steady but growing somewhat. When you and I grew up, if we got cut or something happened, we went to the doctor's office in our town. Now nobody goes to a doctor's office except for routine visits. If you have an emergency, you go right to the emergency room and the hospital will sew you up or do whatever needs to be done. This is a change, and emergency rooms are being used more and more as the first stop for some kind of illness. And if you have the flu, you'll call the doc and he may well send you to the hospital if you're an elderly patient. So the emergency room is really the first line of defense in illnesses, and the whole thrust toward working without patients is becoming a major fact within hospitals. Likewise, and along with this is the one-day surgery, at which there has been a tremendous growth in the 1980s. I'm not sure the figures exactly, but in 1980-81 we did somewhere around 10 to 15% of surgery on a one-day base. Now it's somewhere around 70% of the surgeries at Sharon Hospital are provided for people who will be home that night, up to such things as a hernia, which our son had 3 or 4 years ago, and he had a hernia operation and was home that night for appendicitis. He was in simply overnight and home the next day. So that these are our major changes in the way we operate. In the late 1980s, 1987 to be exact, I mentioned the resignation of Paul Sternloff, who is now retired and deservedly so, and then the appointment of Jim Sock as the president of the hospital. Since his appointment, Jim has reorganized some of the administrative functions under the leadership of the board, and we now have, instead of directors of various services, we now have 6 vice presidents of the hospital. And instead of a director of nursing, there is a vice president for patient services in Liz Bowden, and more authority in all of the patient service areas. It's not just nursing. So her role has been expanded. Ray Bull is vice president for plant services. His job is not just taking care of the physical plant, but also looking, as we look to build and architecturally, having the overview there. We used to have a controller. Now Dan Domball is the vice president for fiscal services, and he negotiates with the state back and forth with them. He talks with other hospitals and has a much broader view of the financial direction of the hospital than a controller would. So that we have, Peter Beardsley is, rather than personnel director, he's vice president for personnel. I'm not sure of his specific title. And he really deals in all aspects of people working in the hospital. And then Jim Sock is the president, tying all these together. By the way, Mark Oresco is a vice president who has a more general role, taking care of those things that don't fall into any of the other pockets, architectural planning and so on and so forth. This, I think, has been important because as the hospital role expands, there is only so much that one man can do, and he has to delegate authority, and I think that this is working out quite well.
Jim, while you're at this spot, maybe you could speak about the budget growth over the years. When you were first there, what size was the budget?
The budget in 1980 was in the neighborhood of $10 million. The budget this year is $34 million.
Indeed.
So it's growth. Now, and some of that is inflation, some of it is added service, some of it is simply the tremendous increase in the cost of technology. Matter of fact, one of the things I was going to mention, in 1983 we got a CT scanner, cost $1 million, and that's now 7 years old. It's approaching the end of its useful life. And the CT scanner is now an obsolete piece of equipment. And MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, is the next step, which we would probably move to, which has much greater diagnostic capability than a scanner. It'll cost more than $1 million, but actually it too is now all obsolete. There's another generation coming on board. So, but we will, an MRI is probably in the future of the hospital. Likewise, we had a piece of X-ray equipment that we bought in about 1982 or 3, and I can remember its purchase. We had to make a special budget exception to purchase it, and the cost was $50,000. One of those pieces of equipment you had to have. Its useful life after 7 years was over, and last year we went to purchase another one. And I asked the cost of that, and the cost of the replacement for the $50,000 piece of equipment was $256,000. And you cannot buy a Model A and put it in an X-ray room. You've got to stay up with technology. And this is one of the things that's been driving the increase in medical costs, because so much new and excellent equipment is coming online that hospitals are really expected by the public to have it, and yet the public really doesn't want to pay for it, really doesn't understand why the costs have increased the way they have. Along with all of this, and this is, I think, one of the things that I'm proudest of, as we looked at the movement to outpatient care, the new medical staff, the addition of land and the medical office building, and then thoughts of the nursing home and congregate housing. About 1985, I put a resolution before the board at a December meeting, which we then re-voted in 1986 or 87. And what it did was to philosophically expand the mission of the hospital. It said we're no longer just an acute care facility taking care of patients who may be here for one day or for a stay at the hospital. We view healthcare and the hospital's mission as the overall mission from of service to the community, trying to help keep people healthy through physical therapy, an outreach, provision of drugs and so forth, and we're doing more and more of that with doctors. and also the provision of congregate housing and nursing home and hospital as a continuum of concern for health rather than the narrower traditional hospital role. And I think that was a very significant thing that we as trustees did, and I think that we've been involved with that philosophy long enough so that it's becoming part of really the warp and woof of the hospital and the people involved with it. I guess there's one other thing that I think is significant that's happened, and that is as the new doctors have come, and this goes back a little bit, why there was concern about the service area. In the mid-1980s, the gradual expansion of New Milford Hospital, the movement of Vassar Brothers and St. Francis Hospitals in Poughkeepsie to include Millbrook more and more in their service area, and it just so happens that the chairman of St. Francis was a Millbrook resident. All of these things began to have us become somewhat concerned about protecting our service area so that the hospital would remain strong. Now, 60% of our patients come from the state of New York. Therefore, that western service area, including Amenia, Dover Plains, Pine Plains, Millbrook, and so forth, is important to us, because if we lost 20% of that population to Poughkeepsie, a 20% drop in income or patients would clearly hurt the hospital in financially, and therefore in terms of what it could do. So we began a program of trying to support and help physicians come, internists and family practitioners, who would help to pin down the corners and the extremities of our service area. In a way to describe this that I like is that as a boy I worked on a farm, and since I was the littlest kid working, I was always put up on the top of the hay wagon, back in the days when you loaded loose hay. Mr. Burr, who was the farmer that I worked for, said, "Jim, load the corners and pin the sides together. The middle will take care of itself." And that way you get a good, strong, tall load of hay that's basically square, and the middle fills in just naturally as you pack and move the hay piles around. I think that the analogy is a good one. If you make the corners of your service area, the periphery, strong by service from good doctors, the center part will take care of itself. Obviously, we don't ignore the center part, but I think the analogy holds. Bruce Ginelli is in Canaan, came there, and he's become a fine young member of that community. Dr. Dweck in Millerton, Dr. Reed in Pine Plains, Bill Ellman down in Dover Plains. We have now rented a building and redone it in Millbrook, where pediatricians and doctors will go two or three afternoons a week, which will increase in terms of timing. Dr. Timmel and Amenia, who lives in Cornwall, these are all doctors who've come in the last half dozen years and worked in the periphery of our service area. And along with the specialists that have come in, this, again, this new core has been developed. But I think had we not seen that and done it in 1984-85, we might well have lost some of our service area to competing hospitals. And we have to face it that hospitals are in competition. They're nonprofit corporations, but if they consistently lose money, they simply go out of business. So you've got to be concerned about the service area and what you're doing for the communities that you do serve. So that's another thing that I think, along with all of these other issues, has been significant in maintaining the health of the hospital through the 80s, when a lot of hospitals have gotten into financial trouble. We have not, we are not, and we're concerned about the future, but I think we're certainly in a very strong position today.
Jim, as it relates to these corner posts on the hayrack, mm-hmm. You now have a person who is involved with marketing to some degree and to public information. Could you just address that new position and what it has done for you or for the hospital in the short while it's been running?
I think we all come from a background, at least many of the trustees do, that in my experience working at Yale, the philosophy was if people don't understand what's happening here, it's their fault. I think that's a little bit outdated, and so we realize that we have to try and reach out to the community to explain more and more what we're doing, why we're doing it, and make the community people realize that they are an important part of the hospital, that the hospital isn't something that lives in isolation and is there when you need it. The whole Tuesday Talks program, which has been extremely successful, the first one, they expected about 40 and over 200 people showed up or signed up for it. And these are talks about cancer and intestinal diseases and heart disease and so on and so forth that are offered, I think, monthly on Tuesdays and have been a very popular outreach kind of program. So we're doing more of that. We're not doing enough. But again, we're learning as we go.
So much for that.
I'm just kind of checking here to see if there's something I've missed in the.
There is one thing I'd like to ask you, Jim, as we close the interview. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that back in I guess it was in the 80s, or right after World War II, there were about 100 beds, less than 100 beds. What is it today, and what's going on as far as the utilization of your present facility?
Right. The hospital is licensed for 92 beds. As the one-day surgery became more and more popular 4 or 5 years in the mid-80s, why our census went down, and we actually removed one wing, the so-called East Wing, from daily service. And so our functional capacity right now is 78 beds. But the additional beds are used, most of them, for the one-day patients. In other words, they use that wing not as an in-house, but as a transient kind of wing. With the prospects of a major renovation and a plan we're getting into, and we're moving toward a campaign at the moment, why we would keep the bed count for the hospital at least 78 beds. We are aware that the commission in Hartford will say you can't have 92 beds, we won't allow it, we're going to drop you to 78. We would resist that. We'd like to stay in the 85 bed range. I think realistically we realize we'll have to give up some beds. On the other hand, I think realistically, looking at where we've been, where we are, and the best guess of where we're going, that a capacity of 85 beds would be a good bed number for the next 15 or 20 years. No one can really look out that far, but I think if there's been a trend of the 80s, it's the removal of the hospital from a degree, to a great degree, from the hotel functions, shorter stays or no stay at all for people who are really patients. And that trend is going to continue. I would like to see more flexibility in allowing severely ill people and elderly people to remain longer in the hospital. On the other hand, most people will be treated for shorter stays or have operations with no stay at all, other than one day. That means we simply need fewer beds to provide the same services than we did 10 years ago. Now, if we go to 85 beds, the next question is, is this area growing? How fast will it grow? At what point will 85 beds become inadequate? If it's 10 years, then we'd be foolish to drop to 85. We should stay at 92 just because of building costs. If it looks like it's beyond 10 years, we could drop to 85 with the idea that the building program in 2010 would add more beds to it. But beyond the next decade, I think we get into a guessing game, and I think that 85 beds would be a reasonable compromise.
What about the utilization of space within the plant itself?
Sharon Hospital right now has no space at all. The last building program was completed in 1974, and in terms of hospital equipment, hospital bureaucracy forced on us by Medicare, Medicaid, the Health and Hospitals Commission, simple movement of our adjustment to life with the fax and the Xerox and all these other wonderful bureaucratic pieces of machinery, there is simply no storage space. And we are in desperate need of added square footage for pieces of equipment. There's one machine on the third floor, which is an X-ray type of machinery. And if you walk into the room, which is about 10 by 10, you will see over 2 feet from the wall a piece of linoleum that's been cut out, and there is another kind of a rubberized pad there. And that's where the doctor stood while using this machine with a patient on the table. Now that pad is under the middle of the new machine, and the doctor is halfway toward the door. Not only that, there are two other pieces of sophisticated machinery in this 10 by 10 room. There's no room for people to work. When the room was built in 1974, it was adequate for machine A. Now you've got brand new, larger, much more sophisticated machine A prime, but you have machine B and machine C that didn't exist 15 years ago. Not only that, you've got all the paper, the equipment, padding, this, that, tools, you know, wrenches, pliers, and so forth that go with these things, and where in the world do you store them?
Indeed. In closing, Jim, could you tell me about your earliest recollection of the hospital and your involvement with it?
Oh yeah, I was a student at Salisbury from 1945 until I graduated in 1948. And during my time there, there were three or four of us who were very interested in biology. And we actually, with a teacher, a master, Peter Ogilvy, requested permission to have a second year biology course. And George Langdon, the headmaster, agreed that that would make sense. We were interested. Peter had developed a curriculum that made some sense. So junior year, I took a second year of biology, which is tremendously unusual 45 years ago. Oh, God, it is 45 years ago. And one of the things we did as a lab, there were four of us, and two of us went over so that either one night a week or two nights a week on alternate weeks, we worked at Sharon Hospital as orderlies. We went over right after dinner, and Peter would come over and pick us up at 10:30 in the evening. So we worked there either 4 or 8 hours a week. So I became familiar. My first memory was working as an orderly, taking temperatures, doing essentially orderly work. Along about 9 o'clock, I'd go down to the kitchen. We'd make BLTs for the nurses on duty. And believe it or not, the kitchen is exactly the same as it was in 1946, I think the year was. But it's a very different hospital now than it was then.
Jim, thank you very much for your time. And it's evident to me and those who will listen to this tape that volunteerism has been an integral part of your life. Thank you.
Right.